Renewable fuel is nothing new. More than two decades of innovation in renewables power every drop of Neste Mine, the first of its kind to be top-tier certified. Reducing GHG emissions with a fuel made from 100% renewable raw materials. So if you're ready for a way forward, we'll lead the way. Run on Neste Mai Renewable Diesel.
Welcome to Drilling Deep. I'm your host, John Kingston. Happy Thanksgiving to all who celebrate. And by the way, who doesn't celebrate Thanksgiving? I had a boss in the UK once, and when he first started managing Americans, he just did not understand Thanksgiving at all. He thought it was sort of a stupid holiday. And one year, he pretty much ruined the day of a colleague of mine by calling him something like five times on Thanksgiving on stuff that could wait just so he could show his unhappiness with the holiday. He eventually got the message, don't mess with Thanksgiving. We drill deep here on Drilling Deep because you don't get oil and or diesel without drilling for it. And if you're going to drill, you might as well drill deep. That's why we call the show Drilling Deep. Our guests this week are two executives from Wabash, from trailer supplier Wabash. The trailer market gets overlooked but a lot in trucking, but the fact is, let's face it, you're not going to move much freight if you don't have a trailer. Wabash has begun a new partnership initiative, and they will be here in a few minutes to talk about it. It's a good thing this podcast is dropping early due to Thanksgiving, because it gives me a few days before anything I say here can be proven to be totally wrong. I say that because next week, the OPEC Plus group will meet in Vienna to plot out their strategy for next year. That meeting was supposed to start on Sunday, then it got pushed to Thursday. That could be significant. We'll talk about that in a minute. Before we go further, let's define what we're talking about here. OPEC is the long-standing group of oil exporters with its core in the Middle East. OPEC Plus is OPEC plus a large group of oil exporters who are not in OPEC, but who have aligned with OPEC in order to restrain production. Its most important member is Russia. Just a few months ago, the assumption was that we'd be closing out this year with a Brent price of $100 per barrel. OPEC Plus agreed to cut 1.16 million barrels per day in May. Saudi Arabia added another million barrel per day cut in July on top of that. And by the end of September, we were only $4 to $5 away from $100 Brent. Brent is the world's crude benchmark. But a funny thing happened then. One that, if you know economics, shouldn't really have been all that odd. The higher prices started incentivizing more production. Right here in the U.S., over the last few months, production of crude oil has increased by a whopping 1 million barrels per day. When analysts talk about the non-OPEC or OPEC plus countries that have had big increases recently, they always cite Iran as a member of OPEC plus. But then a couple of countries are not in either of them that have had a lot of production increases are Guyana and Brazil. And within OPEC itself, like I said, Iran has had a significant increase in production. The result has been a fairly steady decline in oil prices as those new supplies have offset the impact of the OPEC plus cuts and the Saudi cuts as well. Brent has been below $80 recently. A couple of times it's been below 80, and more recently it's been a little bit above 80, but figure about $80 per barrel is where we're at now. So here's the problem that OPEC Plus faces. And if you're a transportation company, it most definitely is not a problem for you. The International Energy Agency came out recently with its monthly report looking into 2024, and the numbers that matter the most or that it expects world oil production next year to jump to 103.4 million barrels per day from around 101.8 million barrels per day in the fourth quarter of this year. We're obviously in the fourth quarter now. That is a jump of 1.5 million barrels per day. But it only sees demand increasing next year by about 900,000 barrels per day after a big jump this year of about 2.4 million barrels per day. Even with that big increase in demand this year, and even with OPEC Plus cutting production, 2024 is setting up to be a big problem for the world's oil producers. Supply is simply increasing too fast, given that the relatively tepid projection of increase in demand. And even with that supply restraint this year and in OPEC Plus and a big increase in demand, $100 Brent just seems like a pipe dream at this point. So what might OPEC Plus do next week? If you listen to this after the meeting is held, you can laugh out loud at all the things I got wrong. They could simply roll over the existing cuts. If there is a consensus right now in the market, it's that they will do that. The group could also implement bigger cuts. But given the fact that countries that are part of the deal are starting to produce above their quotas, that might be tough to implement. The Saudis alone could cut further. That would put their production below 9 million barrels a day, and that is generally seen as a figure that they do not want to drop under. Or, and here's what the real conspiracy theorists are saying, the Saudis could try to punish all the new production in the world by increasing their own production and tanking the price. That would make a lot of this new production uneconomic. They've done that before at times, and they may not do it this time, but it's kind of fun to speculate, isn't it? The fact that the meeting got pushed back a few days is, I think, significant. It could be a sign that the pre-meeting discussions are not going well. A lot of times they like to go into these meetings with an agreement in hand. Basically, they finished 90% of the agreement. They just have a few things to work on after that. That they could not get this meeting off the ground on Sunday and need to push it 4 days hence is a sign, I think really everybody thinks, that they are not in agreement on what to do next. And this could be very interesting. The world's oil consumers here at Thanksgiving should be thankful that like the oil industries of a lot of countries, the U.S. being at the top of that, has given this world a lot more supply. Just when everybody figured we were going higher on oil prices, more supply raised its head and forced the price down. We'll see next week how some of the major producers of the world react to that.
This message comes from Neste My Renewable Diesel, approved by leading manufacturers and the first fuel of its kind to be top-tier certified, made from 100% renewable raw materials. Make the switch by visiting nestemy.com.
Going to move on here now on Drilling Deep. You know, we talk about trucking markets all the time at Freight Waves in general, Drilling Deep in particular. And today we're going to talk about the back half of what's rolling on down the road, the trailer. With us today is Richard Mancia. He's the Vice President of Global Procurement at giant trailer manufacturer and supplier Wabash. He will talk about a recent partnership that the company has signed with a couple of shippers. And we're also going to be joined by Tim Griesgraber. He's Vice President of Sales at Wabash. So, guys, welcome to Drilling Deep.
Yeah, thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
I think the best thing to do is for you to, because what really caught my eye when I got the press release from you, you know, and why it's not just another release, because I get lots of them, is the nature of these partnerships. Like, what is the difference between just leasing a trailer or lots of trailers to a company and engaging in a partnership? How is it different?
Yeah, so on the lease versus buy aspect of things, so I think there's a couple of ways we think about it. So your question, leasing versus buying, typically there's a couple ways I'll answer that. One is if you're a large asset-based company that typically buys your trailers, those companies are typically using leasing as a way to supplement their capacity, either due to production timing. That could be a cause. It could be that they have some CapEx restrictions where they're not able to actually purchase the trailers, so they're kind of supplementing their fleet. So that's one aspect. And then another way to think about it, however, is there's a lot of non-asset-based companies out there that if you are approaching a large shipper, you need a drop trailer solution to participate in those. So that some of those non-asset-based companies, as they try to participate in those RFPs, that's where they're starting to get into that leasing aspect of things.
So when you talk about a non-asset-based company, are we mostly talking about brokers, or is that too much of a generalization?
It falls into that. That's right.
Okay, so in this partnership that you talk about, are the end users buying the trailers, or are they leasing the trailers?
from a customer perspective, they're either buying or leasing. So when we're looking at like a customer long-term agreement, the big thing that we're looking for is, you know, first we start with kind of our portfolio. So who's going to be the company that's going to be the leader in 5 years? And then, you know, then the type of purchasing that they make, are they leasing? Are they buying? It's kind of up to the company. The tenets of the long-term agreement remain the same, whether they're leasing or buying. It's just kind of more of a financial decision at that point.
Okay, but let's talk about not so much leasing versus buying, unless that's at the core of it, but let's talk about being a partner, okay, versus just being a customer. So let's say I'm a long-term customer of Wabash and I've been leasing or buying trailers from you for 10 years. You say to me, I want to engage in a partnership with you. I think you said you have four of them out now. How different then is the relationship under a partnership than it is what it replaced?
Yeah, Richard, do you want to dive into kind of how we think about,
Let me step in there and just talk about what we're doing on the supply side. So first, when you think about strategic partnerships, yes, it's mutual value. We're sharing knowledge, we're sharing technology, but what we're doing on the supply side is relatively unique, where we're introducing relational agreements. And yes, relational agreements is a type of LTA. It's going longer, but it focuses primarily on the relationship. So we're in a standard agreement, it's rigid, it's focusing more on terms and condition and protecting each organization from risk. In relational agreements, it's not about power and leverage and shifting risk to the other party. It's about a shift in mindset and behavior and how we're dealing with our suppliers. And so it's highly collaborative. It's a partnership where we're creating value over a longer period of time. And we're jointly developing a framework that's flexible to ensure our interests as well as our suppliers' interests are continuously aligned over time as our business needs change.
So when you made the announcement, the one that caught my eye, it was with a company called Rockland Flooring, which I guess makes flooring. Talk a little bit about how that went from a customer relationship. I hate to say standard customer relationship, but you know what
we've had a partnership.
How did you get from one to bringing them in on this sort of higher level?
Over that time, we've been able to build a level of trust and transparency. And when you couple that with going longer on the commitment side in the agreement, it results in a greater investment in technology and innovation. We're getting better quality, more capacity, cost management, and ultimately this all benefits our customers.
Now, let me ask you, are the trailers, what is the size of the fleet that you supply them with?
Yeah, I think one thing, John, you know, so you got Richard and me. So I represent the sales side, right? Customers. Richard represents the supplier side. And one of the things that, and just, I'm not going to directly answer that question because Rockland's more on the supply side of things, but one of the things we've tried to do with these long-term agreements is if you start to think about a customer long-term agreement and then a supplier long-term agreement, what Richard and I are trying to do is how do you eventually connect those things through from a planning perspective. So, you know, a lot of the supplier ones that Richard can talk to better than I can started with, you know, how could we change the mindset if we're thinking more in 5 to 10 year increments? And then from a customer standpoint, we started that process later, probably 2 years ago, when we really started to kind of actually formalize how we think about long-term agreements with customers. And now we're at this stage about how can we integrate from a customer all the way through to a supplier? So, ultimately, Rockland, being a supplier, we're trying to think through how can we leverage that and kind of from a supplier standpoint to build longer term agreements with customers. So really trying to bridge that, I guess, is how we're thinking about it.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
All right, let's do some definitions because I'm a little confused here. You know, when I hear supplier, when I hear the name of like Rockland Flooring, I assume that they're a manufacturer of flooring materials and they need trailers to move their product to market. You're just defining them as a supplier. In Wabash world, what is a supplier?
The supplier is a company we're going to be procuring goods or services to help manufacture our products that we then sell to our customers.
I see. So they supply materials to you for you to build your 53-foot That's trailers right. and any other type of size trailers, correct?
Correct, yeah.
I see, which That's is why you're here, because you're the head of procurement. Okay. Then talk a little bit about the relationships, the partnerships that go with a customer, somebody who wants the trailer to move their own product to market.
Sure. Yeah, so a couple of things on how we think about it. So we have a few different channels that we sell to. We have what's called our direct portfolio of customers. So they're your Fortune 100 companies that you would think of that are larger fleets. And then we also have a dealer channel as well that typically are selling to small to mid-sized fleets. So that's from a customer standpoint, that's typically who we're talking about when we're talking about just from a van perspective. Now, when we get into like a look at that direct portfolio and we start to look at the companies that are in there and who do we think is going to be the innovative leader in 5 years, that's kind of how we start to think about strategic portfolio planning. And what we'll do, quite honestly, we don't force LTAs on customers because, well, we can't. But the other piece is we start with a socialization of it. So we'll say, hey, we've had a long-term partnership. We think if we think outside of these one-year increments and start thinking into five-year increments, what can we do differently? So then that starts getting you thinking differently about perhaps advanced R&D or how we even marshal resources to support them. Like we might put maybe folks on site at the customer. There might be different things that we do there. Just getting outside of that 1 year cycle type of thinking into more of a 5 year kind of starts to open up your thinking. Now this takes discipline too, because part of the tenets that we have of our long-term agreements is we need senior leadership alignment. It's not just a salesperson walking in anymore. It's more strategic account management, and it's that orchestration of the resources that Wabash can bring to the table, and then the customer has to bring the same level of resources to kind of really match that. So, and that discipline, that's QBRs, that semi-annual alignment. It's making sure the right players are in the room at the right time. It's not something that is for the faint of heart. It actually requires effort to really pull these off in the right way. So. That's kind of how we think about that portfolio and how we eventually evolve it into a long-term agreement. So hopefully that helps.
How long is the process by signing these people up? And you indicated you go to them and say, hey, look, we can take this relationship up from an annual type of thing to a more longer term relationship. You mentioned 5 years, maybe that's standard. How long does the convincing process take?
Yeah, it's been as short as 1 year and as long as 2.5 years. The cycle can get pretty long. Richard, I don't know if you want to answer on the supply side, kind of how long those have taken. But customer side, it's been anywhere from 1 year to 2.5 years to really start to. Yeah, takes a while. It goes from socialization of the concept, and typically people say, yeah, that sounds good. Like I like the feel of that. Right. And then it takes a while to kind of pull in the right players. Sometimes it evolves. It's not just like an equipment buyer. Sometimes it starts to evolve maybe into their sales team on how we need to think about things. So it takes more people to make this work. And that's what starts to take longer. So depending on the complexity of the organization, it can vary.
Outside of the fact that thing, oh, I'm
yeah,
sorry, go ahead, Richard.
Supply go ahead. Side, it takes, on the supply side, it takes about 12 to 18 months as well. These are complex agreements. So very similar to what Tim described there on the customer side. So
outside of the fact that things just go slowly in general, things never go as fast as anybody wants them to. What are some of the kind of pain points or resistant points that you have to persuade a company to overcome to enter into one of these relationships?
On the supply side, it's not so much about persuasion. Both parties do want to engage in this level of partnership, but it's just breaking the traditional norms of trying to protect your own party of risk. And you know, very similar, like a term and condition, like termination for convenience, and having these standard T's and C's that we're just really accustomed to. And when you move towards a relational agreement on the supply side, you're breaking down those walls and you're shifting away from that type of power, that type of protection. And you're moving now towards true partnership and trust in that both parties are going to work together to resolve issues and create value.
How many, maybe you can tell me now, give me some indication. These discussions obviously are, again, we've shown that they're not short in duration. I'm sure they're complex. How many would you be having, let's say, right now, that might lead to a long-term deal? I mean, you can only do so many. Your plate gets rather full.
Yeah, you can only do so many. And we're very thoughtful and deliberate on how many we want to execute. So we're working on a handful at the moment, but don't want to quote a specific number, but we're working on a handful of discussions with.
That would be the same on the customer side.
Right. Yep. How with the freight recession, how has your progress changed? Has that made an impact? I mean, this is a long-term deal. It's a kind of thing that takes vision that goes out several years, maybe a short-term bunch of headwinds in the freight market might not be an issue, or is it an issue?
It hasn't really impacted our approach on it. The customer's lens on it can change. Like, are they more willing to move quicker in a slower time or not? You know, so it kind of depends on the customer. If it's the right customer, though, which we spend a lot of time focusing on who is the right customer for these. Like, it's something we talk about. They're going to see through a downtrend or an uptrend. I mean, it doesn't slow down from that aspect of things. But that's the whole point of it. The whole point of the long-term agreement is to not think in the one-year cycles. And so.
All right. Let's go back to the buy versus lease discussion. I just coincidentally, I was at the Rail Trends conference in New York last week, all about railroads. And somebody put up a graphic there about the percent of rail cars that are owned by shippers and the percent that are leased. And it's an enormous number on the lease side versus owns. Is that imbalance quite the same in trucking? I kind of go back to what you said before, that there are companies of very different types of approaches. A 3PL is not probably going to buy a lot of trailers, but might lease them. What's the kind of split in general? Not necessarily part of these partnerships, but just in general.
From a just overall market perspective?
Yeah, if you can give me you're not going to give me very specifics on your on all your details, but you can just kind of give me a ballpark number.
That's a good question. I don't know if I know that. In terms of just how many from a. Yeah, I'm not sure if I know that answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the cost of a new 53-foot trailer today, roughly?
I don't think I can share that here.
Okay. All right. How about the used market? That's such a wide open market. Do you have any numbers there?
Yeah. Used, you can go. I mean, you can definitely get some good market information there just by going out to different websites, you know, and looking. I would say the cost of a used trailer for sure has changed quite a bit. You go back 1-2 years, it was selling for more in a lot of cases than a new trailer. And now we've seen it kind of come back to a little bit more normal. It really depends on the age of the trailer as well. So a trailer that is highly maintained and a 7-year trailer, you can sell it pretty well. If you didn't maintain it, then it doesn't go for as much. So there's a lot of factors that go into the used there isn't one number really that kind of you can say. It just depends on age of trailer, use case. You know, some trailers get really beat up in certain applications depending on what you're hauling. So it can vary significantly.
Okay. Richard, you're on the procurement side to actually build these trailers. How bad did it get for you in terms of the supply chain problems, let's say coming out of the pandemic in, let's say, 2021 or maybe even into 2022? When did things kind of normalize?
It was unprecedented, that's for sure. And things started to normalize probably in 21, second half of 21 is when things started to get there. I don't know what normal or normalized means today. So we're kind of in a new definition of what normal is now, but we're still going through constrained challenges on the supply side. But we do have excellent partnerships with our supply base to put us in the best position to get the capacity that we need to fulfill the demand of our customers.
Let's kind of wrap it up by talking a little more about these partnerships. Do you ever engage in a company in a partnership discussion and then like halfway through you decide that you don't want to do the partnership for whatever reason, that you don't think they're a good candidate for it?
We haven't experienced that on the supply side. We do a lot of work beforehand to really vet and determine if it's the right fit and the right path forward. There's a lot of back-end work, a lot of upfront work that we do, and preliminary discussions that we have with our suppliers before we enter into the negotiation.
Yeah. Very similar on the customer side. We haven't had any one where we've, because to Richard's point, the pre-work on identifying the right company is an important step. And then, you know, the question you asked earlier was a good one on how long does it take. The reason it takes so long is typically we feel it's the right company to work with. It's just taking longer to work through some of the complexities that come into navigating it. So we haven't had one where we've kind of backed out because we've already kind of socialized it. It's just a matter of, feels like it's a matter of when versus a big shift there away from a company.
All right, Tim, I'll let you have the final question. Kind of you're in sales. So generally, how would you describe the trailer market right now?
Yeah, trailer market right now, I touched on it a little bit earlier. For 24, probably normalizing the more pre-COVID levels, some of the questions you were asking on leasing, because the secular trends still point to an increase in trailer pools. We're still seeing that drop and hook, power-only solutions. So we feel good about long-term demand overall. In general, the reason I can't answer your question on the leasing is because on what the market looks like, we've actually seen an increase from our customer base of a desire to have more asset-light solutions, like a lease or trailers as a service or different things. So we've seen an increase in that due to the secular trends of increased trailer pools, drop and hook, power only, and those things. So, definitely more normalizing the pre-COVID, but the trends we're seeing long-term are positive.
All right. We want to thank Richard Mancia and Tim Griesgraber. They are both with Wabash National. They have been talking to us about their partnership program with either on the supply side coming in or the trailers going out the door. So, guys, thank you for joining us here today on Drilling Deep.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, John.
You have been watching Drilling Deep. We are part of the FreightCast family of podcasts from FreightWaves. You can find us on all the leading podcast platforms. And if you're watching this, if you're seeing our beautiful faces, you are clearly watching on YouTube. I've been your host, John Kingston, and please join us again.
This message comes from Neste My Renewable Diesel, a drop-in replacement for fossil fuel that has the power to keep your fleet running at top performance while lowering greenhouse gas emissions compared to fossil diesel. Visit nestemy.com to learn more.